Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about narratives, those stories we tell ourselves and others to make sense of our lives. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. You know the stories, the ones that we tell our new sweethearts about ourselves, the ones we tell ourselves to make sense of life events and all the things that are going on around us. Those stories we tell, says my guest, have tremendous power. Edit them, and we have the chance to inspire and empower ourselves and others. Psychologist Timothy Wilson and his team have tested their results or sought out tests by others to see if these strategies work to improve parenting, to manage and empower adolescents, empower loved ones and ourselves using these direct prompts that we're going to talk about. Timothy D. Wilson's book is just out in paperback. It's called Redirect, about changing the stories we live by. The writer Malcolm Gladwell calls it a masterpiece, which is why I picked it up. It is very interesting and enlightening, I think. Dr. Wilson holds the Aston Chair in Psychology at the University of Virginia, where he received the All-University Best Teaching Award. His classes are very popular, as you might guess. Welcome to the show, Professor Wilson.
Hi, Faye. Thanks for inviting me. Good to be here.
Oh, it's good to be with you. Tell me how you first got on to this idea of these narratives, the stories we tell ourselves.
Well, it is kind of a fundamental assumption of my field, which is social psychology, that the lens through which we view the world is often more important than what's actually out there in determining what we do. So, you know, I was, I guess, indoctrinated early on that this idea of it's all in our heads is what really matters.
Please explain what you're talking about. Am I right to say the stories we tell other people, the stories that we make up about ourselves or the events around us?
Yes, I am very fond of this story metaphor that our interpretations of the world are what really matter. But I should say that when they apply to ourselves, the kind of stories and assumptions we make, they're not necessarily fully conscious. So I think, you know, we all have kind of fundamental assumptions about who we are and why we do what we do. And yes, we can communicate them to our partners to some extent, but, you know, they're not always that easy to put into words.
So let's do an example so this can become clear to listeners. And I want to invite listeners to join the conversation just a little bit. So give me an example of one of these narratives that you might be talking about.
Sure. Well, maybe the most concrete way to do it is to talk about a study we did a number of years ago with college students, first-year college students who were struggling. They weren't doing very well in their classes and were worried about it. And our sense was that they were at a crucial fork in the road in terms of the stories they told themselves about why they weren't doing very well. So imagine they got a bad grade on their first psychology test. What's going to happen next? Well, it all depends how they explain that to themselves. There may be one student who says to herself, this just confirms my worst fears that I can't make it in college. I'm not college material. And as a result of that story, she doesn't study very hard for the next test and confirms that by not doing well. Now imagine another student who gets an equally bad grade on that same test, but she explains it very differently. She says, well, I guess this is a wake-up call. I didn't study hard enough. I need to learn better study habits in college. And that story is going to lead to very different reactions and behaviors, and she's going to work harder and probably will do better on the next test. So the study we did was to try to get students at that fork in the road and nudge them onto the better story path by simply pointing out to them that many people struggle at first, that it's not necessarily a sign that they can't make it. And this was a very brief message we gave to students in the psychology building. We brought them in one by one, and some were randomly assigned to get this so-called story editing message, and others were in a control group. And we just wanted to see if that had any effect. And somewhat to our surprise, I must say, it really did, that those who got the nudge onto the more optimistic story path did better in their classes and were more likely to stay in college.
So it's not just the resilience that seemed evident in some of those students who had that experience, bad test, first test, and said to themselves, oh, this is a sign. I've got to redouble my efforts here. This is harder than I thought. I'm going to really apply myself now. That sounds like resilience. We're hearing that word a lot lately.
Well, I would say that one reason some people are resilient are just because of that interpretation or story they told themselves, that what makes us resilient often is an interpretation of setbacks as barriers that we can overcome rather than the pessimistic story that we might as well give up because we just can't do it.
So what you gave them was a prompt. Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
And did the way you gave them that message matter?
Well, that's a good question. And I think it did. That in our study, for example, we never told the students that we were trying to help them in some way. They thought they were just taking part in a survey. And as part of that, we gave them this information that lots of students struggle, but things can get better. And I suspect that if we, in a way, their defenses were down. They were open to this information in ways they might not have been if we had specifically said, hey, we can help you here. So, I do think the way people receive the information matters. In some studies, people try to reinforce it by getting people to write about it and often communicate to others what the story might be, and that's a way to drive the message home that it applies to them as well.
So let's do as you do in the book, take on that message that when the government put out all those commercials about using drugs, here's your brain on drugs, and they were scrambling eggs in a pan. And I mean, there have been a whole series of these. And by and large, as you point out, these don't seem to work. So can you analyze this for me? What's going wrong with these messages? How do you make that link?
Well, I think, often you have to engage people a little more than just these little spots. Now, I think some public service messages can work, but I think ones that are overly simplistic or just seem implausible. I mean, we're not that gullible, I guess I'd say, that we just accept any message out there. It has to be convincing. It has to engage us more, and we have to convince ourselves that, yes, this applies to me.
So what is wrong with, I'm using the most flat-footed government commercial or anti-drug commercial that was out there. There were others that have tried, and those haven't seemed to stem the tide of either drugs or drinking among young people. And so I'm trying to get you to say where messages like that might go wrong.
Well, maybe the best way to answer that is where they can go right. And I think a better approach, one that's used on many college campuses, is the so-called social norms approach, where you try to correct people's thinking about what their peers are doing. And, that's people in college and high school or at an age where few things matter as much as to, what their peers are doing. And many people at that age have a misconception, thinking that others are drinking or taking drugs more than they actually are. And simply pointing that out, that, hey, you may think that everyone's out there boozing it up and taking drugs, but in fact, there's many people like you who maybe aren't that interested in it. That's a powerful message because it's changing the perception of a norm as to how I might want to behave. But just saying, your brain is like on drugs, I mean, it just doesn't engage people. It doesn't really, I think, get them to think of themselves in a different way.
Uh, there is a commercial out right now that's an anti-smoking commercial, and I saw it the other day, and it was so powerful. And when I was reading your book, I was thinking and thinking about it, because it was bunches of very cool kids who just had this appealing nature and way that they were acting and behaving, and each of them saying in these close-ups really fast that, smoking was creepy because it made the person smell bad, or it's just unhealthy. And it went through this. And when I looked at all those kids, I thought, wow, that's powerful. And I thought, why is that getting to me? And I thought, well, because it seems like all the cool kids you'd want to be.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one, but it sounds great. And you know, cigarette companies were very very skillful at doing the reverse to get people to smoke. You know, one of the best examples is the Marlboro Man. That, you know, Marlboros were originally a cigarette that wasn't associated with manliness. It was not selling very well. And once they started that Marlboro Man campaign, where here's this cowboy, this independent guy, yeah, we all want to be like that. So I'm glad to see that they're combating it with saying, no, you know, it's you won't be the Marlboro Man. You'll be someone with bad breath and bad teeth who no one will want to date. I think that is powerful.
This is Dr. Timothy Wilson, and he's a psychology professor at the University of Virginia. His book is now out in paperback. It's called Redirect, Changing the Stories That We Live By. So let's talk about these prompts, and then we'll get into this probably the most important study in your book, which is this writing exercise. Is it Pennebaker? Is that...
He's the one who pioneered one of those techniques, yes.
Okay, so when you say prompts, you mean a suggestion to somebody about how they might look at something.
Yes, I think, you know, one thing we sometimes forget as parents or just as friends is the role we play in shaping each other's stories. And I think that's powerful. You know, I'll give one example that I came across recently that I was really struck by. It was actually an episode of This American Life in which they talked about a man named Daniel Kish, who became blind at the age of 13 months. And his mother decided that she was not going to treat him as a blind person. She would treat him exactly the way she would a child who wasn't blind. And it led to a lot of bumps and bruises because he would climb trees. He actually learned to ride a bike. And little by little, he adopted this story himself that, you know, I am not disabled. And he actually developed a way of navigating around by clicking his tongue and using echolocation, to the point where if you saw him walking down the street today, you would never know he was blind. He's able to navigate streets in strange places just like you or me. And, you know, this is an extreme case, but it really shows how his mother instilled a story in him that had life-changing consequences for him. And on a lesser scale, I think we all do that, certainly parents, that we shape the narrative of our children in ways that hopefully enable them to be successful.
All right, Dr. Wilson, please stay exactly where you are. I want to come back and talk more about this writing exercise that has had such a powerful effect on people. And we'll take a short break and come right back. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks so much for joining us. We have Professor Timothy D. Wilson on the line with us, and his book is now out in paperback. It's called Redirect, Changing the Stories We Live By. There's a foreword by Daniel Gilbert, and Malcolm Gladwell has called this book a masterpiece, so it's good that it's out in paperback. And it's talking about the narratives, the stories we tell ourselves, and how small editing of these stories can change the entire forward momentum of our individual lives or those we love or care about, and the ways that that happens with using these prompts, doing it on paper, and that's what this book is about. So, Dr. Wilson, would you tell me about this writing experiment that ongoing has had such a profound impact?
Sure. Well, this has been pioneered by a social psychologist named James Pennebaker, and he finds that for people who are troubled about some event in their lives, particularly if it's been preying on them for a while, so it's not something that happened yesterday, but perhaps something we've been concerned about for some time, that the simple act of taking out a piece of paper and writing for maybe 15 minutes, 3 or 4 nights in a row, in which we just open up and try to write down our deepest feelings and thoughts about this experience. Now, it sounds simple, but it has been shown in well-controlled experiments where people are randomly assigned to do this or not, that it leads to long-term benefits of people having better health, better immune systems, going to work more often. And I think the reason it works is that it's often these things that prey on us are the very things we often don't want to think about and confront. And this writing exercise is, and also things that we don't fully have a handle on as to why they happened or what they mean. And this writing exercise forces us to confront that and often change our view or our sense of why this event occurred. So typically what happens is it's hard. People often cry at first. It's difficult to force ourselves to do it. But if you look at what people write, when it works well, people start out with jumbled accounts of this event in their lives. But by the end, they've reconstrued it into something they understand better, they see more meaning in, and as a result, they're able to put it behind them more easily than they could before.
So I've turned to this section in your book, and it says, you know, you start with this idea. There's something in your life that you're worried or upset about right now. And if it's been on your mind for quite some time, and it keeps bubbling up to the surface, almost in that kind of PTSD way, then you would start this writing exercise for 4 consecutive days, 15 minutes a day. And you want to write without interruption. There's this second part of the exercise that seems so important, and it's called stepping back and asking why. Can you explain what you mean?
Sure. Well, this is a variation of the writing exercises, which was developed by some other researchers. And it's really interesting. The idea here is to gain perspective by looking at ourselves as a third person through the eyes of somebody else, a fly on the wall, say. So, you know, take a concrete example. Suppose that there's something that made us angry. Maybe we had an argument with our boss, and we stew about it, and we just can't seem to quite move beyond. Well, with this exercise, you take out that paper, and you imagine that you were a fly on the wall looking down on this episode and write about it from this third-person perspective. It can help sometimes to actually use, instead of using first-person pronouns, saying, I did this, actually use your name. So in my case, I would say, well, Tim did that, and my boss did this, and then Tim did that. And if we do that, and particularly if we focus on why the event occurred, that combination of third-person perspective, thinking about why, really triggers a reconstrual where we come to see the event differently, typically in ways that make sense of it in a way we hadn't done before, and again, allow us to move beyond it, to put it behind us.
The thing that reminds me of is mindfulness, because if you're practicing mindfulness, you're sitting there letting thoughts in your mind come to the surface and just observing as they go by in a way that distancing you're calling for, only you're doing it on paper, is the same thing. Yes?
Well, there are some similarities, and the research shows that mindfulness can be very beneficial in those ways. I do think the writing exercise is certainly a more active approach, where you are not just observing and letting thoughts go by. You're actively trying to reinterpret and see them in a different light.
What about people who have genes, if this is the case, that make those people into the curmudgeon types? And so pessimistic by nature, and other people who have that more optimistic set of genes. How does all this work on those two different kinds of people? Is it fair to say that we come into the world that way?
Well, there certainly is a genetic component to optimism and pessimism, but you know, like most traits, it's not the full story. I think it's something we can cultivate. If we are one of those curmudgeons, we can try to see the glass as half full. And there certainly are benefits to doing so. There are lots of studies that suggest that optimists are people who bounce back more quickly from setbacks and do better in life. I should hasten to add that it's not just positive thinking. It's not just sitting in our armchair and thinking positive thoughts. The thing that sets the optimists apart from the pessimists is actually what they do, that they try harder. If they experience a setback, they're the ones who can find a way around it and work hard. And as far as these writing exercises go, I don't know that there's any research specifically looking at whether they work better on optimists versus pessimists, but I guess you could say it's the pessimists who ought to do it more in many cases.
If they are
looking at things more negatively, and if they can try to see things a little more optimistically, that should help.
How is what you're talking about different from the old Saturday Night Live Stuart Smalley routines, where I'm good enough, where he would sit in front of the mirror? What's the difference between this positive self-talk mumbo-jumbo versus what you're asking us to do?
Well, good question. And I always was tickled by that skit. And there's certainly others that have argued for positive thinking, Norman Vincent Peale and the book The Secret. And, you know, I do think there's a grain of truth in this, but the major difference is that it's not simply a matter of saying to ourselves that I'm a good person or I'm trying to just think positive thoughts. It is, I think, digging deeper and finding some meaning in events that cast it in a better way. It takes a little more work, perhaps, to write and think through particularly something that's troubling us. And I think that's why I say the Pennebaker technique, it's doing it a few nights in a row can help to really get beyond our defenses, dig down, and really try to see it in a different way.
Don't I also remember you saying in your book that to deliver the message to yourself in that most simplistic Stuart Smalley kind of way can do the absolute opposite thing?
There's at least one study that suggests it can backfire, particularly if it seems so implausible. So if it's a person who doesn't have very high self-esteem and just repeats, I'm a good person, it can backfire by saying, wait a minute, no, I'm not. This isn't working at all. And yes, that is a danger.
So in other words, the unconscious of that person says, and look how pathetic this is that I have to repeat this sentence. That's how bad I am, kind of a thing.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
What do you think from the research that we know and what you folks do in positive psychology? What does lead to happiness?
Well, that's a great question, and I think most happiness researchers would say at the top of the list is really good relationships with other people, having lots of friends and spending time with them. From a little more psychological point of view, I think there are, as I say in my book, there's three ingredients: meaning, hope, and purpose. That hope we've touched on. That's trying to cultivate optimism. Purpose is a sense of we're working towards something, that we have goals that we care about, and we're making progress towards them. And meaning is a belief system that sort of puts it all together and seems a coherent view of the world where things make sense. And there's, you know, various ways of achieving those, religion being one of them, but not the only one, to give us a sense of meaning and purpose that leads to happiness.
The point that you make very strongly in the book is that there are it's a multi-billion dollar industry, the self-help industry, and much of it untested. Though, you know, let's say that these authors and publishers are at least aspirational. You know, so maybe one half of that dynamic, they want to make some money, and the other side would be nice to make money, but they really believe that these things are true. But untested, so we don't know, and sometimes we test them and we find out it's nonsense. Well, one of the things you focus on, as I remember, is that baby Einstein thing where, you know, it was just like Mozart. If you were listening to Mozart or doing certain kinds of activities, that your child would be a genius. Intelligence would skyrocket. And so then they did an experiment, right, with these parents. And this was, they said, well, let's look at vocabulary for kids. How are they going to really learn something? So do you recall this study?
Yes. This was a study actually done by a colleague of mine, Judy DeLoach. And, you know, I do think this is one thing that sets, you know, the research psychologist apart from the self-help industry, is we try to put things to the test and actually see whether these things work. And in this particular case, they got mothers with their toddlers, and they randomly assigned them to see one of these tapes that's supposed to boost vocabulary. Or they asked the mother to just try to teach the same list of words that was in the video to the kids however they wanted. And it turns out that good old-fashioned just spending time with your kids and teaching them words and using words worked much better than just passively watching a video with the kids. That kids aren't very good passive learners, and so unfortunately we can't turn our kids into geniuses by just plopping them in front of a video.
Uh-huh. So the kids whose parents tried to teach them the words,
they learned the words much better.
Much better. They hadn't even seen the videos.
Right,
those
correct.
Kids learned the most words.
Correct.
So that would be in terms of capacity, resilience, that relationship part that you were talking about.
Yes, I think so.
An example of why that's important. Here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to open the phones, and if you have questions for Dr. Wilson about redirect, changing the stories that we live by, and you possibly have an example of how you've done this in your own life or with someone you care about, where you help that person reframe, and perhaps yourself, reframe how you think about something, please call and or jump in with me and ask questions of Timothy D. Wilson, whose book, now out in paperback, called Redirect, 203-776-WNPR, 203-776-WNPR. This past weekend, I was reading the New York Times, and I go through it section by section, and I got to the one with all the marriages in it. And the vows story this time featured two men getting married, and one of them, when he was interviewed by the writer, was asked, I guess, he was a minister and had been very closeted as a gay man, and he said he was ready to get married, and that he had gone through some program, and he had realized by taking that course that it was his right and a privilege to be gay. And I stopped on that sentence, and I thought, a privilege to be gay. Wow. I was in the midst of reading your book. I thought, that is the most fabulous framing. Here's a man who's not only thinking about equality, but he was thinking about a privilege in terms of, I'm sure, all the wonderful gay people in the world, being alive, the sense of community that he has gotten from gay life and gay culture, and on, I'm sure his list goes. I can't begin to do it for him. But I thought, fantastic framing. What do you think?
No, I agree. That sounds great to be able to view yourself as a privilege in any respect is just sounds wonderful.
203-776-WNPR. In terms of parents and teenagers, where things really start to get hot in terms of relationships, and kids can either seem invincible or end up down on themselves, depending on the challenge. What is it that the parents might learn from this idea of rewriting narratives?
Well, it's certainly a challenge, I can say. My kids are adults now, but I do remember the teenage years. And I think one thing we learn is simply telling kids to be a certain way is usually doesn't work. And, there is one way that we haven't touched on that is a great way to change one story, and that is the so-called do good, be good principle that often changing our behavior is a way to trigger changes in stories about ourselves. And there's some really neat research with teens showing that getting them to engage in volunteer work, for example, can really make them refashion their image of themselves. They begin to see themselves as not so much as a disengaged rebel without a cause, but more as someone who is a good person, who has a stake in their community, and who other people depend on them. And so, getting our kids serving as good models, doing volunteer work with our kids, that's something that I think can work.
I have been to many, many bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, and always part of that, the child is at the lectern, I guess I'll call it, at the temple, and telling all of us sitting in the pews, well, here's what my social work has been in pursuit of this. And each one is asked to do something for others, and each one tells, well, here's what I've done. And I don't think I quite understood the purpose of that until I read your book. I mean, it just sounds like a good idea, but I see what that does.
Yeah, no, it's very powerful. Very powerful.
So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to talk more about changing the stories we tell ourselves and the stories we live by, those narratives. It's all here in the book, Redirect. Psychologist and psychology professor Timothy Wilson is staying with us. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much to our producers, Jonathan McNichol and Lori Mack. Our guest is Dr. Timothy D. Wilson, author of this book and paperback, Redirect, Changing the Stories We Live By, using prompts for ourselves and suggesting edited narratives for others around us who seem in need of that assistance, and this book talking about how to do that in a real, authentic ways that have been tested as opposed to theories about things that work. Dr. Wilson, one of the things you do is sum up at the end of your book, you've got this list about skepticism to some degree and what parents can do to be mindful of their children in certain ways. I want to get to that with you in just a second. Ray, welcome to the show.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hi.
I love the topic you've got.
Thanks. Do you have a story on that?
Yes, I was listening to the reframing about the blind person, who was able to see. And I volunteer with veterans, been doing a program called Take a Vet Fishing for, we're going in our ninth year now, where we get vets out of the hospital to do something different. And through that, some friends and I had a chance to go to Walter Reed Medical Hospital, where injured soldiers are getting state-of-the-art treatment to heal their amputated limbs. And we walked into the hospital room of a man who had lost both his legs. And to the four of us that were there, he looked us in the eye and told us that he was convinced that he would be a better person because of what had happened to him. And it took my breath away, and it took me a while really to understand what was going on there. But in his mind, this was going to make him a better person, and he was determined for that to happen.
This is what you're talking about, Ray, is such an interesting point, because we have heard some say to us, some things are so horrible that it's just awful to suggest that people, you know, must learn from these things, you know, to pressure them into. And on the other hand, there's a kind of grace that comes to some people that is like a resilience, where they see, it's the narrative includes this part about I see assets from this horror that I've endured. Dr. Yeah. Wilson, what do you say?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for that example, Ray. It really is inspiring. And you know, I certainly don't want to give the impression that everything is in our heads and that sometimes life sends things our way that are horrible and difficult to deal with. But often what separates you know, the people who are resilient are those who are able to find some meaning in it, some lessons that, as hard as that sounds, I think some people are able to do it, and my hat goes off to them.
Yeah, thank you, Ray.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. What a good sounding program that is, Take a Vet Fishing. I love that. Is that online, Ray?
We'd love to have you check it out sometime.
Is it online? Is there a place? Can people
yes.
Google that and they'll just get to it?
Best place is look Take a Vet Fishing on Facebook in Connecticut.
Great. Terrific. Thanks
thank
a lot, Ray.
Have a great day.
Okay, you too. So, Dr. Wilson, you say that it's important if you're a parent to be mindful not only of what your kids do, but of the narratives that you see or hear them developing about themselves or about their relationships, maybe about the world. And there's this idea of helping them develop these healthy core attachment narratives. What do you mean by that?
Well, there is a theory called attachment theory that says that we develop stories about relationships from a very early age, depending on how our parents responded to us, how responsive they were to our needs. And I think that's true, that we all have these core narratives about what relationships are like and what other people are like. And you know, if we have such a narrative that isn't so healthy, I think it is something that can change, we can work on by developing trusting relationships with others as best we can. I think some of these writing exercises can help. And as parents, you know, there are some important lessons here for example, I think it's natural for us all to want to be maybe a little controlling, especially of teens, to keep an eye on them. But there's a danger to being too controlling, of course, that it can prevent our kids from developing their own narratives about experimenting in the world and who they are if every move they make is being controlled by their parents. So, you know, giving our kids a little bit of freedom to fail, not in dangerous ways, of course, but to let them develop those narratives on their own is hard, but important to do.
I saw a little boy whose sister was chosen. These are twins for an art show, and he was not chosen. And I saw this tender little boy just stand there and cry. And I really thought I would just break into a million pieces, you know, watching this happen. And I thought, my hat's off to his mother who, you know, tried to explain that these things happen in life. I think I'm using this as an example because it is so hard to get what you just said right.
Yeah.
Autonomy on the one hand, and on the other hand, these kids want us to set limits, and very difficult.
It is difficult. And, you know, as a college professor, I see it even at the college level of helicopter parents zooming in and trying to you know, intervened if their kids get a bad grade or something, and you know, it's giving the kids some distance and letting them figure it out is hard but important.
You quote Kurt Vonnegut, and I want to get to that in Mother Night. I want to get to that in a second. Margo, thanks for calling 203-776-WNPR. Go ahead, Margo.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering if you've done any research or what your thoughts are on how this works or helps people who are dealing with chronic diseases. Or maybe even terminal diseases. And I bring it up because I recently heard an interview with, I think he was a college professor in Minnesota, and he was stricken with ALS, which is a progressive degenerative disease. There's really no good outcome. And he was talking about how once he, I don't think he used the word reframe, but he said once he started to view what was happening not as something that he needed to fight, but that it was an elegant progression, that he came to really accept it, and that his life, the time he had left, the quality of that was just really so much better for him and his family. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
That's a great question, Margo, or comment.
Yeah, I love that example, and it reminds me of one of my own, that I had a very dear friend who died of ALS a couple of years ago, and I was... I guess the only word for it is inspiring to watch how he handled it. That it was obviously devastating at first, but he used it as an opportunity to connect with the many friends he had, and some of whom he had kind of lost touch with. He encouraged people to come visit him, and there was a continual stream of visitors coming into his house, and he embraced that and viewed it as a way to, really with grace, as a way just to foster and those relationships that was really inspiring. So I think that is a great example of where the story really matters.
Yeah, and it's such a great example of here is an illness that you would normally think is by its nature going to distance you from people. And then your friend saying, and this Margo's friend too, both these people saying, I'm going to do the opposite and have people come closer to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
203-776-WNPR. I like this. Well, so you got Kurt Vonnegut here. He said in Mother Night, quote, "We are what we pretend to be, so we must be very careful about what we pretend to be." So that kind of is a reference to your business about teenagers volunteering and
yes.
What that gives them.
Yes, this do good, be good principle that you know, for example, there is research with people who are depressed that sometimes the hardest thing to do is to get up and get out and do something to engage with others. But forcing ourselves to do that is often a great anecdote to engage with others.
How would this, Dr. Wilson, work with a prejudice? Because you address this in your book.
Well, It's something social psychologists have done a lot of research on, or the nature of prejudice and its causes, and particularly many angles. And you know, one line of research that I've done is looking at how to encourage people of different backgrounds to interact with each other. That, you know, it's well known that one of the best ways to reduce prejudice is to increase contact between groups under equal footing and safe circumstances. But getting people to do that is often a challenge, to be willing to reach out and maybe get out of their comfort zone and interact with people who they maybe harbor some ill feelings towards their group. And, I do think there's ways to, by giving examples of other people who have done it, some of these writing exercises, to just encourage people to take a chance. If there's someone you work with who you wouldn't normally interact with because they just seem different, I think our natural assumption is, oh, they wouldn't want to interact with me because, they just aren't interested. Well, often they're thinking the same thing we are, that, oh, I bet, you know, that person just isn't that interested in crossing that divide. Hmm. But just taking that first step and reaching out can have remarkable effects sometimes.
Mark Faith Middleton with Dr. Wilson, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Faith. I'm a Marine Corps veteran, combat engineer, and I always kind of replay an incident that happened in 1983, excuse me, where we were woken up at 5 in the morning, and Egyptian soldiers, I was in Egypt, and Egyptian soldiers and police were trying to shoot 10 or 11 year old boy.
Did he make it, Mark?
I'm sorry?
Did they shoot him, Mark?
We tried to intervene, and we were ordered not to get involved. The kid, it was a homeless kid, and he stole vegetables. And it turns out he stole vegetables out of the police chief's really nice house. And there were like 35 soldiers and police shooting AKs, trying to kill the kid.
Yeah.
And I wanted an interview.
Oh, Mark. Oh, it's so hard, Mark.
I mean, I always think of the guys, died in Beirut, but this kid, he was just a kid.
Yeah. Mark, no, please don't apologize.
And I'm trying to explain to people, I don't know, it's, you can't, how do you explain something like that to somebody, and, they're having a bad day or something, and you want to, there are days where I'd like to fucking, you want to slap somebody upside the head because it's like you have no problems, But as far as the doctor saying about writing, I'm not a, big person on writing. So does he have any other suggestions, like he mentioned about volunteering? I've done that before.
Mark, thank you for sharing your story, as hard as it is. I really appreciate that you did that. And thank you for your service also. It means a lot.
Yep.
Yes, Dr. Mark, Wilson.
It is amazing how fresh this is after so many years. And if you've tried the writing, then I do think that talking to others and professionals, I think sometimes we do need to seek help from others. And if something's troubling us to that deeper level, I'd encourage you to do so.
Yeah. Mark, thank you very much for being part of this community, and I hope you will stay a member of it. Thank you.
Thank you,
my friend. Okay. There is some discussion in the book about PTSD, witnessing these horrific events and how they repeat. And I found that very interesting. And as you say in the book, we need more actual studies, correct?
Yes, I do think I think we do. But again, these writing exercises are worth a try.
Yeah, thank you so much, Timothy Wilson, University of Virginia, Cheryl Aston, Professor of Psychology, author of this book, now in paperback, Redirect: Changing the Stories We Live By, forward by Daniel Gilbert, and called a masterpiece by Malcolm Gladwell. Thanks, Dr. Wilson.
Thanks for having me, Faith. I appreciate it.
As always, this show is about the richness of life. Find the book we're just talking about and many others, People, Recipes, Value Wines, and Cocktails, right now at Faith Middleton on WNPR.org. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.